good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go right,
you're listening to episode 659 of Unwelcome Guests, Countering Intelligence, Part 2. I'm Robin Upton. This week, follow-up to last week, we continue where we left off in Scott Noble's film, Counterintelligence. In the middle of Part 2, going to add a couple of extra pieces in. Going to replay some vintage Mike Rupert talking about the connection between drug deals and political influence in the US. Going to hear Mark Crispin Miller from episode 561, small piece on conspiracy theory and the origins of that particular term, how that was inserted into the public vocabulary through assets in the commercially controlled media. And we're going to have the soundtrack of a video about the bombings of the Russian apartment buildings in the run-up to the war on Chechnya. So without further ado, we continue. This is towards the end of part two of Scott Noble's film Counterintelligence. Noam Chomsky speaking on An American Addiction.
Without proceeding with the horrors in Colombia, what's it all about? There is an official story, the one you know. It has to do with the so-called drug war. That's not taken seriously by any competent analyst, and that's no exaggeration. And there's some very good reasons for it. One reason is that narco-trafficking is part of the elite culture in Colombia. The sectors of the population to which the arms are going are up to their necks in narco-trafficking, and that's by no means any secret. Furthermore, they're not being targeted. So although the paramilitaries are right in the middle of the narco-trafficking system and are responsible for the overwhelming majority of the atrocities, up to 80% last year, if you can believe the Colombian government, they're not being targeted. That's not where the fighting is going to go, not to the territories that they control. And there's good reasons for that. They're basically the armies of the landowners, the narco-traffickers, the oil companies, and so on and so forth. You don't go after them. The Colombia plan, Clinton's Colombia plan, is specifically directed against the areas that happen to be under guerrilla control.
We see a plane flying over Colombia, spraying some chemical from its crop spraying add-ons. And a forlorn woman looking over dead crops, saying, everything's dead, everything just dies in its path. Where the poison falls, everything just dies.
I had about 50 papayas growing over there.
They're all dead now.
And it's in that framework that drug production proceeds. There's a way to stop it. For example, you could allow commodity stabilization programs in the third world. You could provide a fraction of the money that's going for to kill people could be used to develop alternative crops. The socioeconomic problems in Colombia, which are extremely severe, can be dealt with in several different ways. One way is to try to change the internal structure of the country, to follow programs that would in fact benefit the population instead of oppressing them. That's one way. The other way is to go in and kill them. There's a further question kind of lurking in the background, which is never raised, but really ought to be. It's not a very profound question. And that is, what right do we have to do anything in Colombia?
Peter Dale Scott, author of The Road to 9/11.
Wherever you declare a war on drugs, you get more drugs and not less drugs. That's an absolute certain rule. And when the 1990, I think it was when the first President Bush declared a war on drugs in Colombia, and I predicted publicly at a conference, I said, we will see more drugs coming out of Colombia now that we've declared war there, and there are more planes going back and forth, more personnel going back and forth. And lo and behold, in 10 years, it was three times the amount of cocaine being produced in Colombia.
And we switched to an interview by Russia Today of Adrienne Pine, assistant professor in the Department of Anthropology at the American University, Washington, D.C. and the new subtitles inform us thousands of bodies found in mass graves near Colombian Army base.
You wonder why the United States is continuing with the massive amount of aid to Colombia when none of the stated goals for Plan Colombia are being met.
Are there any indications that they're rethinking this aid now upon this news, or with what you're saying, that they haven't made a lot of progress on the goals that they had in the country?
Quite to the contrary, and I would say what this tells us is that the United States actually didn't have these goals in the first place. The aid that they're bringing in include 7 new military bases. So there's a huge new influx of military aid to Colombia rather than addressing the issues.
Marcia Esparza from the Historical Memory Project.
There is a continuum of U.S. hegemony in the Latin American context, in the region. People in Latin America are pretty aware of this. I mean, when I go down to Chile, for example, and people talk about the war on drugs or war against terror. People see the continuum, a continuation of the same mechanisms of violence that are targeting exactly the same population, the poor, indigenous peoples. It follows the same logic of the U.S. Doctrines of national security in the region. They are all part of the same ideology, which is to demobilize those people who are mobilizing in order to achieve social justice. It's the same thing.
According to Laura Carlson, the director of the program of the Center for International Policy, the drug war has become the major vehicle of militarization in Latin America, a way for the Pentagon to occupy and control countries at the expense of whole societies. South of the border, the drug war has claimed 47,000 lives between the years 2006 and 2012.
According to The Guardian, 87% of firearms seized by Mexico during the previous 5 years have been traced to U.S. arms dealers. Globally, so-called developed nations, in particular the 5 founding members of the UN Security Council, that is China, France, Russia, the UK, and the US, from the CRS report for Congress, quote, are generally the largest arms dealers, unquote. The biggest market for arms are the so-called developing nations. Their biggest supplier, nearly half, is the United States.
The Iran-Contra affair of the 1980s was a, so far as the press was concerned, they focused mostly on the fact that profits from selling arms to Iran, which was actually illegal under U.S. law but done by Oliver North for the White House, that those profits had been used to support the Contras. The drug aspect of Iran-Contra is on the Contra side, partly because some of the Contras themselves were drug traffickers, particularly the original corps who came out of Somoza's National Guard in Nicaragua, which had used its privileged position to traffic in drugs back in the 70s before they were ousted. But on an even bigger level, which the press mostly missed, the big-time drug traffickers, the people who moved cocaine from out of Colombia and through Central America up to the United States and had major planes for this, they all volunteered to support the Contras, either by lending their aircraft to the movement of arms or by direct financial subsidy of the Contras. So the big drug aspect of Iran-Contra was not what the Contras themselves were doing, because they were mostly pretty small people, but it was what major drug traffickers in particularly Mexico, in Honduras, and in Colombia itself, what they were doing to buy themselves what we call CIA immunity by being useful to the Contras. So that the CIA and eventually even the U.S. State Department ended up giving official contracts for movements of supplies to airlines, which the DEA had already recognized as being drug airlines. In some ways, the whole pattern of how the drugs moved was based on the relationships that all of these various CIA clients had with each other.
And I oppose any diversion of funds, any ransom payments, or any circumvention of the will of the Congress, the law of the United States of America.
Now, I thought we'd take this opportunity to break from the radio adaptation of the film, re-listen to classic Unwelcome Guests episode, or small piece thereof. This is episode 23, Double Dipping into Misery, Crack the CIA and the Prison Industrial Complex. It's Mike Rupert. It was first broadcast on the show in August 2000.
Thank you, Didon. Just shout out your answers. Somebody name for me the four states in the United States that are responsible for most of the importation of illegal drugs. Through what four states do they come? Texas, Florida, California, New York. Texas, California, Florida, and New York. DEA Department of Justice estimate that around 70-plus percent of all illegal smuggled drugs come in through those four states. $250 billion, a quarter of a trillion dollars every year. This is from University of Ottawa Economics Department, my research, a lot of other good research, is laundered through the American economy, meaning that drug money is moved through American financial institutions, businesses, stock purchases, to make that money legal and usable. Through what four states is most of that $250 billion laundered? Go ahead, shout it out. California, Texas, New York, Florida, the same four states. From what four states do 80% of all presidential campaign contributions come? Texas, California, Florida, and New York. Who governs Texas and Florida? The Bushes. Why does Hillary want New York? Ah, could it be? These are some of the things that we begin to put in perspective when I begin to tell you a little bit about how the hows and the whys that the Central Intelligence Agency has been dealing drugs for more than 50 years, since even before it was the CIA. Now let me tell you something about the Central Intelligence Agency. The man who wrote the National Security Act of 1947 that created the CIA, his name was Clark Clifford. Who can tell me what Clark Clifford did for a living? He was a banker, Wall Street banker and a lawyer. He brought us BCCI, the drug bank that bought American banks in the 1990s. He wrote the Act in 47 creating CIA. Now, who designed the CIA and told Clark Clifford how to write the Act? It was two guys named John Foster and Alan Dulles. What did they do for a living? They were lawyers in the Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, the largest law firm on Wall Street. William Casey, who was Ronald Reagan's director of Central Intelligence, what did he do for a living? He was a lawyer, and he was a stockbroker, and under Richard Nixon, he was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. The CIA is an agency that has, for its entire existence, acted for and on behalf of Wall Street. When you begin to comprehend that, you begin to understand why, out of a half a trillion dollars a year, as Le Monde, the wonderful publication from Paris, puts it so eloquently, we have evolved into a situation where the wars of this century will be for the control of illegal money. Who can control the profits of a trillion-dollar crime industry and a half a trillion dollars a year in illegal drug money? There are a great many ways I can explain that to you. Now, let me say, while I have your attention, that I'm the publisher and editor of From the Wilderness. It's a newsletter we have at the back table. We're now read by 12 members of Congress. We just picked up Slade Gorton and Patrick Leahy, who are both opponents of U.S. involvement in Colombia, the intelligence committees of both houses, and professors at 10 universities. We also have a fabulous book up there at the table from a very dear friend of mine, Celerino Castillo, a true American hero, who stood at Ilopango Airfield in El Salvador and watched CIA personnel orchestrate plane loads of cocaine flying into the U.S., personally confronted George Bush, only to be told, leave it alone, it's a White House operation. There are only a few copies of Sully's book, and we have them back at the table, and they're autographed. I encourage you to support him, because half of every sale goes directly to keep him in house and home. Now that I've done the commercial, I love you too. I want to talk a little bit about the economy, because when you understand the role of CIA and drugs and why it happens, you will begin to understand how the whole system fits together. I shared in a panel earlier today. Now, this is very hard to see, but we don't have an overhead. But if I were to tell you, and almost everybody here is from L.A., that this is the Santa Monica Freeway right here, and this is the Harbor Freeway right here, you would say that this mass of black dots is South Central Los Angeles. Wouldn't you agree with me that that's South Central Los Angeles? Now, what if I told you that this map, prepared by a former Assistant Secretary of Housing, each one of those dots represents the foreclosure of a single-family home loan in South Central Los Angeles that defaulted between 1982 and 1990. There were many casualties of the crack cocaine epidemic, but economically speaking, the rich people have always had an idea that it's always better to use the poor people's money to vanquish them than spend their own. So they could bring the cocaine into Los Angeles and take all the money from the sales of cocaine, drive the property values down to the point where people who had $120,000 mortgages could no longer keep the payments because the neighborhood had turned into a war zone. The children were in jail, dead, or in the hospital, and they couldn't sell the house for what they owed on it, so they walked away. And years later, some other investors, namely a lot of white-owned, but there were many other, some black-owned, and some Latin-owned and Oriental-owned mortgage companies came and bought these houses in groups of 10, 15, and 20 for 20 and 30 cents on the dollar. Okay, this is an economy that makes profits on everything, but it's called a search and destroy, is what I call it, a search and destroy economy. Okay, these were single-family home loans, private companies. Who knows? I don't know. I do know, but it would take me an hour to answer the question. What I'm saying is they were all private investors who were heavy political campaign donors who kicked the money back to the politicians who kept the whole thing going. Now, they won't tell you that. Now, I caught CIA, I became a witness to CIA dealing drugs more than 24 years ago. I come from a CIA family. I work for LAPD. I didn't discover this because I was an LA cop. It's not something every LA cop knows. It happened because I come from a CIA family, and my mother was a cryptographer for the Tehran conference in 1943 with Franklin Roosevelt. Okay, I was being groomed to be a CIA agent or officer within LAPD. Now, I never worked for the agency, but I met a lot of agency people inside LAPD who carried badges and guns, but they were CIA more than they were LAPD cops. And that's the way the agency protects its drug trafficking. Okay. Now, I was forced out of LAPD in 1978, years before the Contras, but I had seen it firsthand, and I was shot at, and I won't bore you with all the details. They weren't boring at the time, but I won't go through that now. What I'm saying is that there's a great many of us who know. There are people in a court of law, eyewitnesses. The first thing a DA asks for, did anybody witness the crime? Well, I'm an eyewitness to CIA dealing drugs, and so is Sally. We're the first people you would want to talk to, but we've been ignored. But I want to talk about an issue of proof. People say there's no proof. And I'm going to tell you right now, we have so much proof that before a jury of any rational men and women anywhere in this country, we could prove right now that the CIA is criminally complicit in the drug trade. I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about that. You all remember the Gary Webb stories from 1996 about Freeway Ricky Ross, the Dark Alliance series, which brought CIA Director John Deutsch to Locke High School so I could beat up on him for a little while. That was fun. And the big investigations that came as a result of that. That's Gary Webb's fabulous book, Dark Alliance, which goes further than any other toward really documenting direct CIA involvement. Well, a number of investigations were started as a result of that, and as a result of my confrontation with John Deutsch. Now, these are excerpts which I publish, but the report from which these excerpts come is a CIA report. And I have a huge website, and those of you who want to write it down, it's www.copvcia.com, copvcia.com. And you can link directly to the CIA report, which is about 460 pages. But I have pulled these 60 pages out of that report, and I've made my editorial comments, but these are the CIA's own words. In their report, which was released on October the 8th of 1998, the CIA admits that it, throughout the course of the Contra War, it dealt with 58 known narcotics traffickers. It admits that it kept six of them out of jail. It admits that it deliberately lied to the United States Congress about the role of drug trafficking played by its assets and employees during the Contra War. It admits that it briefed Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush on how it was lying to Congress about trafficking by its agents and employees and assets on a regular basis, and that Vice President Bush approved. It admits page after page after page, but let me just read you one little example, okay, when we talk about proof. Paragraph 490, and I've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. How am I doing on time, all right? Paragraph 490 talks about a guy named Moises Nunez, okay? He was a CIA contractor, in essence. He was on a State Department subsidy. The poor guy wasn't making enough moving 200 kilos of cocaine a week, so the State Department had to give him a little extra to supply humanitarian aid to the Contras. And he was caught with 200 kilos of cocaine and taken into custody, and the CIA talked to him, and they wrote here, he says that Nunez revealed that since 1985 he had engaged in a clandestine relationship with the National Security Council. That's the White House that oversees the CIA. That's Oliver North, okay? He had engaged in a clandestine relationship with the National Security Council. Nunez refused to elaborate on the nature of these actions, but indicated it was difficult to answer questions relating to his involvement in narcotics trafficking because of the specific tasks he had performed at the direction of the NSC. In other words, he's dealing the cocaine for the White House. It's right here, CIA's own report. Okay? In the next paragraph, CIA says, well, we didn't know what to do with this guy, but it says, the next day, however, a headquarters cable stated that headquarters had decided against debriefing Nunez. Don't ask him any more questions. Direct cable from CIA to the field. Page after page. A company called Setco, moving 4 tons of cocaine a month, owned by Juan Ramon Mara Ballesteros in Honduras, was using bank accounts that were opened by Oliver North. It's right here in the CIA's report. Now, let me read you the most stunning part of this. This is the actual letter. It's a memorandum. In 1981, Ronald Reagan's director of Central Intelligence and the U.S. Department of Justice began a series of negotiations because it's a law under U.S. code that a government agency must report crimes by its employees. But yet they started a whole new series of negotiations under Reagan, and they suddenly took, at CIA, the highest food level in the food chain is a case officer. That's a card-carrying, badge-carrying CIA guy who can't be disavowed if he's caught or captured. Beneath that, they have career agents, they have contract agents, they have informants, they have contract employees, they have all these other things. And they entered into this negotiations, and they suddenly said, everybody who's not a case officer at CIA is no longer an employee under the law. These are people who were going to get pensions from CIA. Let me read you this letter dated, just one paragraph, dated February 11th, 1982. It's addressed to the Honorable William J. Casey, Director of Central Intelligence, signed by William French Smith, Ronald Reagan's Attorney General. It says, in light of these provisions and in view of the fine cooperation, the Drug Enforcement Administration, Sally may comment on that, has received from CIA, no formal requirement regarding the reporting of narcotics violations has been included in these procedures. By the stroke of a pen, this is the smoking gun document, the U.S. Department of Justice told the CIA that there was no need to report drug trafficking by its employees. Now, if I say to you that we have a criminal government, maybe I will make some sense to you. I hope so. It's clear. It's as clear as the nose on my face. It's as clear as a nose on everybody's face right here, okay? We have a criminal government that is engaged in criminal activity. So why do we question the, why do we act sometimes as if we're dealing with someone that has perfect legitimacy, but we have to work within the system? We have now enough evidence, and I think Bill will probably agree with me, he's a good lawyer, to, we could put the CIA on trial right now and convict them beyond a shadow of a doubt. I would like to take it to a jury, and I think you would too. Okay, but even more so, the United States Congress in May of this year, after 4 years of stalling, after they sent investigators from the House Intelligence Committee to copy 6,000 pages of my records, said, we've looked at all the evidence, including what I just read you, and said there's no evidence that CIA had anything to do with drugs, case closed. That's the House Intelligence Committee. They read what I just read you and hundreds and thousands of pages more and said there's nothing wrong here. And yet, just 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, that's one level below the Supreme Court, in hearing the case of a Contra leader, Renato Peña, who was fighting extradition, said, we've read these same documents, and Mr. Peña's making a claim that the CIA sanctioned his drug trafficking, and we think he's right. He needs an evidentiary hearing. So that's pending, but our case just got very strong. Stronger. Now, want to show you a couple more things before I turn this over to Bill. If you can see the headline on this story, it's called The Democratic Party Presidential Drug Money Pipeline. I wrote this in the April issue of From the Wilderness. It has been nominated for a $20,000 prize at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. In this article, I document how Charles Manette, the former Democratic National Committee chairman, with Tony Coelho, has established a drug money pipeline going directly into the Gore presidential campaign. And it was done through the Dominican Republic, where Charles Manette is now the U.S. ambassador to the Dominican Republic, which is a backwater posting for anybody in the State Department. And in fact, no political appointee has ever taken the position as ambassador to the Dominican Republic since 1957. Yet just last December, Charles Manette, one of the most powerful lawyers in the world, a former DNC chair, voluntarily became ambassador to the Dominican Republic. And then I produced a sensitive classified intelligence report out of the Department of Justice saying that one-third of all the cocaine entering the U.S. passes through the Dominican Republic. They don't tell you that in the major media, do they? Then I documented how Coelho and Manette had in the 80s been tied to a drug smuggler named Barry Seal. And I also tied in this article the fact that the Dominican Revolutionary Party, which is headquartered, of course, in the Dominican Republic in Washington Heights of New York City, had made direct cash contributions to Al Gore in 1996. If you don't play with drug money in this economy, you can't play at all. And until you understand that, you don't understand how it all works. And that's why I say over and over again, the way to pull the plug on the whole rotten system is to decriminalize. It worked with Al Capone, didn't it? It put the bootleggers out of business, didn't it? Why are we so afraid to touch that subject now? Well, I'm going to shut up in a second, and I'm going to invite Dion up. I just want to say that I took this evidence right here, and I said in 1998, we don't need anything else other than what's in this report to sue the government. Thank you.
And we return to Scott Noble's film, Counterintelligence. This is inclusion of Part 2, The Deep State, from the 2007 documentary American Drug War.
George Bush Sr. came to Guatemala on January 13, 1986. And he approached me and asked me what I did there at the U.S. Embassy, what my job description was. And I told him I was a DEA agent working international narcotics investigations. And I told him, look, you know, we have gathered intelligence that the cartels are involving drug trafficking down in El Salvador. And then he just smiled, shook my hand, and walked away from me. And it was then and there that I knew that my government knew that these atrocities were occurring.
Pete Bruton, author of The Mafia, CIA, and George Bush.
We found a number of people in Florida that were helping the Contras, taking weapons, guns for drugs, that were involved in failed banks and savings and loans. One CIA gun and drug runner was a guy named Jack DeVoe. And DeVoe was actually bringing in his cocaine into the Ocean Reef Club on Key Largo that was owned by Carl Lindner, a Cincinnati businessman.
Oh, and he's very close to Bush.
Very close to Bush. Okay, Bush would go down and actually vacation at the Ocean Reef Club. And there's a picture in my book of Bush in a fishing boat off Ocean Reef. And this is where Jack DeVoe was bringing in his cocaine. And DeVoe was also taking guns down to Latin America for the CIA.
There's a new epidemic. Smokable cocaine, otherwise known as crack.
Let there be no mistake. This stuff is poison.
Little kids doing drugs, it turns my stomach.
Don't mess with them.
Just say no.
Now, DeVoe's money launderer was a Miami attorney named Lawrence Freeman. Freeman had previously worked for Paul Helliwell, one of the founding fathers of the CIA, and also was laundering money for Santo Traficante, the Tampa, Florida mafia boss. Freeman drew up the documents, the sales contract, for a 21,000-acre land deal in the Florida Panhandle that Hill Financial Savings, the one in Pennsylvania we previously talked about, and Vision Bank Savings in Kingsville, Texas, that was owned by Walter Mischer's former son-in-law, financed. And here we have Lawrence Freeman drawing up the papers and involved these people. And he is, you know, closely connected to the CIA, had been the in-house counsel for Castle Bank and Trust in Nassau, a bank that was used by the mafia and the CIA to hide and launder money, and was shut down when Paul Helliwell died. And it appeared that many of these offshore money laundering operations were moved after Castle Bank failed and was shut down, to the Isle of Jersey. And Lawrence Freeman was laundering Jack DeVoe's drug money through the Isle of Jersey. Robert Corson, Mishra's former son-in-law, and Mike Atkinson were laundering SNL money through the Isle of Jersey, along with some people in Colorado that connect to Neil Bush. All were using the same trust on the Isle of Jersey were getting drug money and SNL money, and they were mixed in the same bank accounts.
In 2012, a study of the Colombian drug trade revealed that only 2.6% of the total street value of cocaine produced remains within the country. An incredible 97.4% of drug profits are amassed by individuals and organizations in first world nations. A U.S. Senate staff report has estimated that $500 billion to $1 trillion in criminal proceeds are laundered through banks worldwide each year, with about half of that money moved through United States banks. In 2004, the London Independent reported that drug trafficking constitutes, quote, the third biggest global commodity in cash terms after oil and the arms trade, unquote. According to US Justice Department records obtained by The Guardian, one bank alone, Wachovia, now owned by Citibank, laundered over $350 billion in the 3 years since May 2004. The supposed crime of drug possession accounts for one in four persons imprisoned in the US. According to some estimates, drugs or drug-related crimes account for over half of all criminal offences. Today, a marijuana smoker is arrested every 38 seconds. More people are arrested for marijuana possession than for all violent crimes combined. The United States has less than 5% of the world's population, but almost a quarter of the world's prisoners. The largest prison population on the planet. China, which is several times more populous, imprisons significantly less people.
America, land of the free? Not when one out of 100 Americans are currently incarcerated in either jail or prison, making America the country with the highest incarceration rates in the entire world. The U.S. has only 5% of the population, but holds one quarter of the world's prisoners. Even more disturbing than the rates of the imprisoned is the privatization of the industry. The expanding prison industrial complex has a vested interest in keeping people locked up. Just like the security industry's growing lobbying efforts to implement harsher security legislation that would implement their products, there's a growing trend of private prisons. The prison industrial complex, which has grown 350% over the last 15 years, has been lobbying Congress hard to pass legislation that would imprison more people. Now, the private prison industry is by no means a new story, but the growing number of companies reporting record profits by means of locking people up is. Wells Fargo, you know, that bank that received a cool $37 million from the U.S. government taxpayer-funded bailouts, is also the main investor in four private prisons. That's right. The people that some say should be behind bars are the ones profiting off locking people up. Is this just an ironic twist, or is it good business practice? Earlier, I was joined by Russ Baker, founder and editor-in-chief of WhoWhatWhy.com, and author of the book Family of Secrets. I asked him what sets the U.S. apart from other nations, and why are so many people behind bars in this country? Here's what he had to say.
Right, Abby. What we're doing is we're looking for new excuses to lock people up. That figure you cited, one out of 100, is quite alarming. But even more alarming is the figure of 6 million Americans who are under some form of supervision. They're either in prison or they're in the parole or probation system. That is a staggering figure. The correct term to use would be gulag. And what we're looking at is essentially the criminalization normalization of extremely minor behavior, much of it victimless, coupled with severe and extremely harsh sentences, compounded by putting people who really are not dangerous into very dangerous facilities and turning them into hardened criminals.
I certainly agree that prohibition increases drug trafficking rather than diminishes it. What drives the drug trade is profit. And if the drug traffic is illegal, the profits are far higher than if it's legal.
By now, America is well launched into an era of amazing madness. Bootlegging has grown from small individual effort to big business embodying huge coalitions and combines. The chase after huge profits is followed closely by their inevitable partners, corruption, violence, and murder. A new and horrible tool appears, the Tommy, a light, deadly, wasp-like machine gun, and murder henceforth is parceled out in wholesale lots. Then in the depth of the economic despair that has gripped the country, Franklin Delano Roosevelt is elected president, partially on the basis of his promise to end prohibition. In New York City, thousands of jubilant citizens march in a great beer parade. And shortly, 3.2 beer becomes legal. Finally comes the national referendum on repeal. Tired of years of violence, corruption, and loss of personal liberty, Americans go to the polls and overwhelmingly rout the dry forces. After 13 years, prohibition is dead, leaving in its wake a criminal element used to wealth and power, but unable for the most part to cope with a new determination by an aroused public that law and order should once more reign.
America faces the opposition of most of the European countries who favor a medical approach to drug problem rather than a police approach to the drug problem, and they have actually instituted programs in countries like the Netherlands. It's not legal to buy and sell heroin, but it's not criminal for people to consume it. And this means that addicts go to government-created centers to get their injections. There's actually been a fall-off in drug consumption. But the big benefit from this is that the very major fall-off in drug-related crime. You see fewer thefts for drug purposes because they don't have to steal to get their drugs. You see a marked decline in drug-related prostitution, young women who are selling their bodies to get their drugs. I just finished reviewing a book for an academic journal, and the conclusion of the book is my own as well, is that the rest of the world is waiting for America to abandon its prohibition model of drug treatments and go to a more sane, more humane, and more successful medical approach to the problem.
It's well known how to deal with drug problems. It's not a small problem. I mean, substance abuse is a serious problem. The worst part is tobacco, the next is alcohol, and down below are lots of other drugs. And the way to deal with it is by prevention and treatment. Prevention, of course, means eliminating the social conditions out of which it arises, but just plain treatment. And it's effective. There are major studies which compare the effectiveness, government-funded studies, you know, major ones, that compare the effectiveness of treatment to other approaches. The major one by Rand Corporation compared treatment, prevention and treatment, just in terms of cost-effectiveness, to a criminal justice, what's called, I hate to use the word, what's called criminal justice in the United States, and it was about seven times as effective treatment. They compared it with interdiction, it's about 11 times as effective. They compared it with what's called source country control, that's what we're doing in Colombia, it was 23 times as effective. So by substantial measures, these are much more effective ways of dealing with the substance abuse problem, which is a problem, you know, and you want to deal with it, that's the way to do it. Well, for years it's been pointed out by critics of these programs that they fail to meet their stated objectives, and that's true. They completely fail to meet their stated objectives, and that's recognized on all sides. What do you decide when a program fails to meet the stated objectives? The methods are criminal prosecution at home and mass murder abroad. Well, what you do is you intensify the same efforts and you avoid the methods that you know to work. Well, you know, assuming everybody isn't totally insane, there's another conclusion to be drawn from this, and that is that they are meeting their objectives, not their stated objectives, but the real objectives.
As Henry Kissinger, by his own admission in a secret memo, used to say, the illegal we do immediately, the unconstitutional.
And when I talk about the deep state, I have also to talk about the huge and increasing disparity of income and wealth in this country, so that particularly since World War II, but also before, is very visible in the early history, because nearly all of the senior directors and deputy directors of the CIA were recruited from Wall Street, and not only from Wall Street, but from that part of Wall Street who figured also in the New York Social Register, that is to say, who were wealthy, affluent part of the ruling establishment that prevails in Manhattan. And the deep state is all the ways that those people have influence over American policy. Now, the CIA in the early days was like their special plaything, and when something inside CIA was created called OPC, the Office of Policy Coordination, very innocuous title, very insidious agency which started planning coups and assassinations all around the world. That too was a creation of their policy, and the deep state was embodied there at that time. But there are many other ways in which that influence is exerted. The Council on Foreign Relations, the Federal Reserve. We've just seen a spectacular way in which the Federal Reserve has been using, which is essentially a banker's institution, not democratically controlled by design, has been using public funds to bail out the banks, which are the institutions who supply the various board members of the Federal Reserve. So that, too, in my view, is part of the deep state. It's a whole milieu or venue where private power, the power of wealth, influences policy.
In 2008, capitalism underwent a crisis of gargantuan proportions, leading to economic devastation around the world. In response, the U.S. government launched a series of investigations. As with the Church Committee and the Iran-Contra scandal, stern words were spoken.
The Senate Governmental Affairs Subcommittee on Investigations into the 2008 Financial Crisis.
What do you think about selling securities which your own people think are... Does that bother you?
I think they would... Again, as a hypothetical?
No, this is real.
Well, then I don't...
We heard it today.
Well...
We heard it today. This is a shit deal. This is...
I heard nothing today that makes me think anything went wrong.
Is there not a conflict when you sell something to somebody and then are determined to bet against that same security, and you don't disclose that to the person you're selling it? Do you see a problem?
In the context of market making, that is not a conflict.
Also like the Church Committee and the Iran-Contra scandal, none of the top lawbreakers received any significant punishment.
Robert Parry, investigative journalist.
The problem we then faced with the Iran-Contra scandal immediately was an effort to contain it. Once the White House had to admit they'd been lying all those months and all those years, they then immediately tried to contain it. In the words of Robert Dutton, one of the operatives, the word was out to build a Chinese wall around Ronald Reagan. And they did it. And they did it partly because the Democrats in the Congress decided that it would be too disruptive to this country, to our political system, to get to the truth.
With a handful of notable exceptions, U.S. government officials have repeatedly demonstrated that they are either unwilling or unable to rein in the secret government. On the contrary, the majority of elected officials appear to regard their shadowy counterparts in the intelligence business as comrades in arms.
The main defense of the CIA was made by Democrat John Stennis of Mississippi
a member of the Senate's CIA watchdog subcommittee.
Was the CIA's entrance, in your opinion, was its entrance into the field of public opinion perhaps a little unwise, do you think?
Well, it might have gone further than I would have gone if I had been in on making the judgments directly. This originated in the early 50s. Remember, that's when the Congress was passing here the bill that outlawed the Communist Party, for instance. There was a congressional expression, perhaps in some of these programs that didn't change fast enough. But this is quite serious business. We can't do without it. We must continue it, and I frankly think, I hope at least we'll quit talking about it so much soon, and the people realize, American people realize that this is something different.
The word has already been passed on the Hill, passed from the leadership and from that inner group of men who watch over the CIA. The result is that Congress will do virtually nothing publicly to investigate or reform the agency.
Increasingly, when damning information is leaked, it is met with outrage, not at those whose criminal activity has been exposed, but the individuals who dared breach the wall of secrecy.
John Kiriakou, former CIA agent and anti-torture whistleblower, may never see himself in the National Portrait Gallery, but he was celebrated in a different kind of ceremony Wednesday evening. The portrait is the newest addition in the Americans Who Tell the Truth series by artist Robert Shetterly. Kiriakou is the only CIA officer facing jail time for any action surrounding the government's torture program.
I never tortured anybody, but I'm heading to prison while the torturers and the lawyers who papered over it and the people who deceived it and the man who destroyed the proof of it, the tapes, will never face justice.
In 2011, he became the sixth whistleblower charged with violating the Espionage Act by the Obama administration during the first term.
Well, when it comes to punishing whistleblowers, President Obama is proving to be more aggressive than all previous presidents combined. Pretrial hearings are underway for one of them, WikiLeaks whistleblower Bradley Manning. The 24-year-old Army private is accused of releasing a video which shows a U.S. Apache helicopter shooting and killing Iraqi civilians and two journalists. Manning faces a slew of charges, including aiding the enemy. If convicted, he could face life behind bars.
This guy should be tried. Manning should be tried for treason. Execute him if he's found guilty.
Whoever in our government leaked that information is guilty of treason. And I think anything less than execution is too kind a penalty.
Through the course of the investigation, and as I have said publicly, that he should be charged with treason.
Regardless of the legal standing of this situation, I do think that it was reckless and irresponsible to leak all these cables. I do think that it has the potential not only to jeopardize some very sensitive issues with respect to national security and foreign policy, but you always run the risk when you do this of literally putting people's lives in danger. I'm going to have to thank you all very much. I've got to go.
The New York Times and so on.
Let's dig a little bit deeper right now with the chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, the Democratic Senator from California, Dianne Feinstein. Senator, thanks very much for coming in.
I have some other thoughts. I don't want to discuss them here. I'll discuss them with the committee tomorrow morning. I think what we're seeing, Wolf, is an avalanche of leaks, and it's very, very disturbing. It's dismayed our allies. It puts American lives in jeopardy.
I guess the question is, and you don't have to go into specific details, I would assume they would be classified, but do you know of a specific incident where someone's life has been threatened or endangered? An actual incident as a result of these leaks?
Yes. I can tell you where lives have been endangered.
Has anyone been killed as a result?
Not to my knowledge.
Do you want to go into specifics?
No, I do not.
All right, you don't have to. I suspect that this is sensitive information.
Stephen Cohn, lawyer for Sybil Edmonds, author of The Whistleblower's Handbook.
The state secret privilege, which is this doctrine that essentially puts a censorship veil over everything you want to blow the whistle on. But this fight over the exposure of government misconduct goes all the way back to the American Revolution and the First Amendment. And the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution was enacted to prevent precisely what we're seeing unfolding today. People in the government witness the abuses, and they have a right to blow the whistle on it. And that's where Sybil Edmonds' case, I think, is going to be critical, because we are challenging the legal predicates that they have used to prosecute and suppress whistleblowers throughout this country. And we're challenging them now because they're illegal and unconstitutional. We're taking the offensive.
Now, you are saying that this dates back to the First Amendment, that is freedom of speech. So would you say then that this attack on whistleblowers is then an attack on freedom of speech?
Absolutely. It's fundamental to speech. And if you go back to what our founding fathers said, they said that it's government misconduct, that the government wants to suppress the public ever learning about. So the heart of the First Amendment, its essential core, was to permit people to expose government abuses. But what we see in these censorship cases is that the government is using its power to intimidate, to prosecute, to threaten, and to stop government employees with information, be it waterboarding, information like Sybil Edmonds had about misconduct in the translation services, preventing the American people learning about the abuses of their government. And that's why we have the First Amendment. You know, okay, it's fun, you can read People magazine or watch TV, that's great, it's all protected under the First Amendment. But the heart of it, the core of the First Amendment, is the protection of people who want to expose the misconduct of government.
Glenn Greenwald, constitutional lawyer and a columnist for The Guardian, through which Edward Snowden first went public earlier this month.
There is a consensus across ideological lines and even one that transcends temporal eras about what the rule of law was intended to require. What it really was intended to require is nothing more than the fact that we are all equally bound to a common set of rules, regardless of power, position, or prestige. So you can look at, for example, contemporary legal scholars who write about the rule of law, and what they will over and over emphasize is that the rule of law requires, the defining attribute of it is that nobody is above the law or nobody is below the law. And nobody means nobody. Nobody is above the law, nobody is below the law. And you can more interestingly look at literature from the 1980s and the 1990s. This was during the time when Western institutions, led by the United States, began lecturing the third world and the developing world about what it was that they had to do in order to comport with the rule of law. There were lots of journal articles written about what this term was supposed to mean, and the seminal article, the most influential article, was written by Thomas Carruthers, who was an official at the World Bank. And in 1998, he published in the Journal of Foreign Affairs this article entitled The Requirements of the Rule of Law. It was intended to sermonize to third world countries what they had to do. And what he warned was that the way that you become a country not living under the rule of law, the hallmark of a country that fails to live under the rule of law, that is lawless, is that, quote, the ruling elite's tendency to act extra legally wherever legal systems remain captives of the powers that be. And he said that the most crucial challenge for a country that is lawless to become one that lives under the rule of law is that, quote, elites in the country must give up the habit of placing themselves above the law. That was the defining requirement. The idea that there is nobody above the law or below the law, that even when our highest ranking political officials get caught breaking the law, that they are subject to the same set of punishments and investigations and scrutiny and accountability as the most powerless American. But that is literally not a principle that we apply any longer to the leading members of our political class. The idea that people should be prosecuted when they commit crimes using the power that we vest with them in office is the idea that is considered radical and fringe, not the other way around. It's the immunity that is truly radical, but it's the idea that we should hold them accountable on equal terms that is now considered to be the extremist position.
And that's the end of part two from Counterintelligence. So we move on with part three, The Strategy of Tension. It begins with a quote from Marshall McLuhan. Only the small secrets need to be protected. The large ones are kept secret by public incredulity.
They called it Operation Northwoods. Kept secret for decades, the document was obtained by journalist James Bamford and published in his book on the National Security Agency, Body of Secrets. The author explains, in 1962, the Joint Chiefs of Staff drew up and approved what may be the most corrupt plan ever created by the U.S. government. In the name of anti-communism, they proposed launching a secret and bloody war of terrorism against their own country in order to trick the American public into supporting an ill-conceived war they intended to launch against Cuba. Among the suggestions, a fake hijacking involving remote-controlled planes to be blamed on Cuba, the blowing up of an American ship, also to be blamed on Cuba, and a terror campaign in Florida carried out by anti-Castro exiles to be blamed on Cuba. The most remarkable fact about Northwoods itself was that it was approved by every single member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the highest-ranking military officers in the land. Only when it reached the desks of Defense Secretary Robert McNamara and President Kennedy was the plan nixed.
The idea was to create a pretext to show that there was an attack by Cuba on the United States, and the idea was to have U.S. personnel from the CIA and other places secretly create terrorism in the United States. The documents actually said people would be shot on American streets, bombs would be blown up. And again, all this, the evidence would be laid to point the finger at Castro.
Northwoods was a proposal for what is termed in intelligence jargon, a false flag operation. For students of war, there are multiple overlapping strategies for the defeat of the enemy. The first tactic is well understood: physical violence between opposing armies. The second, far more mysterious, is cywar. In psychological operations, the target is the mind. Not just enemy personnel or infrastructure, but the beliefs, motives, and ultimately behaviors of entire societies. Alexander the Great is credited with one of the earliest recorded examples of the military psyop. When he was forced to retreat from conquered lands, vacuums of power were left in his wake. To discourage pursuers, he advised his craftsmen to build and leave behind massive body armor, such as would befit giants. Breastplates and helmets for mythical men, 8 feet tall. The discovery of the objects would make his enemies think twice before giving chase. The 11th century warlord, Genghis Khan, used similar tactics of creative deception. Prior to military campaigns, agents of influence disguised as villagers from an already conquered region would be dispatched into enemy territory to warn the people of the horrors awaiting them. To further intimidate opponents, Khan devised a trick of light. As darkness fell over his encampments, he ordered his men to light 5 campfires, where only one was necessary. Observing the spectacle, one scout reported back that Khan's army had more fires than there are stars in the sky. In the modern age, cywar would evolve into an art form. President Eisenhower defined psychological warfare as anything from the singing of a beautiful anthem up to the most extraordinary kind of physical sabotage.
Black propaganda, well, let's start with the white propaganda. White propaganda is propaganda, persuasion, news, media operations of one sort or another that are openly acknowledged by their sponsor, which in this particular case is the U.S. government. So the Voice of America, for example, is white propaganda.